Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning, good evening, good night, NBN Entrepreneurship and Leadership.
Personally, I'm fascinated by the story.
Trust is an underrated weapon in the business landscape.
I'm a really, really strong believer in learning by doing.
What's the definition of success?
You're trying to come up with an answer to the question. But go ahead, Richard.
You could be right, but you're wrong. Good morning, good evening, good night, whatever time of day it is, Entrepreneurship and Leadership channel listener on the NBN. Today we've got Greg Rosner with us. Greg's waving for our YouTube audience and we'll say hello in a moment. He's the founder and CEO of Pitch Kitchen. But rather than me try to introduce him, Greg, why don't you introduce yourself the way you'd do it if you just bumped into someone you didn't know in a bar or at a business event?
Right. I'm a Capricorn and my favorite color is green.
It's super valuable.
No.
Everybody. There's already value from the first minute.
I'm a bit worried that the listeners are deserting the podcast in droves.
No, I guess I'm making a point. I'm making a shocking point is that, you know, too many pitches, as it were, like people say what they do. They talk about like, oh, I'm a this or I provide this awesome solution that is just the best thing ever. And we're $1 billion, whatever. And people just glaze over that. They're like, it's boring. Or it's just like, okay, whatever. And I think part of the reason why I started this business is because, when I say I started this business, I didn't even say what business I started, but I left the corporate world to basically start a business that fixes bad sales presentations and boring homepages. Have you ever seen any of those?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I'm here with Keeman. And in fact, we met Greg through Keeman, didn't we? I don't know. Keeman, do you want to say how you got to meet Greg in the first place?
Yeah, I've known Greg and I don't know when. I remember meeting at conferences. We were both in the translation industry and we met. And we used to probably get attracted to each other because we were out drinking late and partying and stuff like that at the conference. So then we probably got talking to each other then. But anyway, yeah, Greg was, you know, like a top guy in the industry. And, you know, I just got to know him over the years. And I just, you know, over the years, what I remember, Greg, is you always had, even though you were working in companies, I think at the time mostly, you always had entrepreneurial ideas. You had, I remember the million, we talked about that the last time we talked actually, the million heads idea. You had a million heads idea.
And then you actually ultimately,
millionheads.com. And you know, and you quit your job to ultimately set up a business. So I just think that's, first of all, super brave and then very inspiring. To people. And actually I also used your services after you, when you set up your company and it is true. And I've always felt this, I actually feel like a kindred spirit. I think what you were trying to say at the beginning is that, you know, when we talk to people, when you're selling to people, you're often just focusing on yourself. It's just like, me. And I've always tried when I talk to salespeople about like, you know, it's not, It's about the other person is understanding their problems and being able to say something that engages them. So I guess that's probably where you're.
So like I'm writing this book right now. You know, Simon Sinek wrote this book called Start With Why. And my feeling is that nobody gives a shit about your why, because who cares? My book is called Start With The Problem, because everybody cares about their problem. And, you know, I think there's 12 conversations in sales that open minds and close deals, but starting with the problem is the way to go. So I think when you say, like, Richard, you ask me, like, what do? I like to say, well, I fix bad sales presentations and boring homepages that sadly make themselves the hero of the story instead of their customer. Have you ever seen any of those? And, you know, that's where it starts.
Yeah, and I noted I didn't immediately dive into that because obviously, you know, you're like a good lawyer. You don't ask a question like that unless you know the answer. Of course, everyone's met people who don't know how to introduce themselves, and everyone's seen loads and loads of really terrible sales presentations. And you did the right thing of asking a question. So I think that for our listeners, we're definitely going to go into this in a bit of detail, because you know, are there any entrepreneurs who don't need to sell? Do you think?
Is that for me, that question?
Yeah, I'm not interested in what Kimon has to say.
Are there any entrepreneurs that don't need to sell? Well, first of all, let's flip selling on its back end. What is selling? It's really, forget about, who cares about selling? People are trying to solve problems, and they need to buy something or change something. So, it's an entrepreneur is not an entrepreneur unless they're solving a problem for somebody. So you don't even have to use the word sales. So if you're not solving a problem for anybody, you're not an entrepreneur. How's that?
So I think that we can use that as one of our slogans. I think that's absolutely perfect, and it's completely correct. I want to backpedal a bit. I'm not totally disinterested in what Kimon has to say. I was just like trying to...
it's okay. I'm used to it. It's okay.
Kimon, I think this is an interesting way of looking. So really, business people, they aren't selling anything. If they're good business people, they're looking for problems they can solve profitably. Would that be correct?
Yeah. Yeah, well, sure. I mean, what's a business for? I think so many people forget that their whole business is purpose, no matter how big it is, started at some point with trying to solve some problem for somebody somewhere, you know? Even Google, right? Solving a problem. How do people find stuff on the biggest web of computers ever? Big problem. But I think what happens is it's natural for people to forget that they're in business to solve problems and to stay focused on the problems that they're solving. And they get involved with operations and features and functions of their solution and their product. And then they see their shiny competitors out there with solving the problems in different ways. And they get so trapped up with trying to differentiate themselves and how they solve the problem is more important or better than their competitors solving the problem. And from a customer's perspective, it's just like, I don't want to use the D word, but it's a big distraction. That's the D word I'll use. It's a big distraction. Yeah. I mean, especially now post-COVID, it's like there's very little competition out there because people are, when I say little competition, in so many businesses, your biggest competition is not who you think it is. It's just the status quo. That's really what you're fighting against, how people are doing things today. That's the biggest competition, not the shiny competitor.
Yeah, and if we jump into your business, because as I understand it, you're helping people with their homepages and their pitches. And I haven't looked into this in detail, but I would imagine there's a lot of other companies out there or consultants out there that are more or less in the same space. You know, you didn't invent the idea of improving these things. So how do people find you, or how do you differentiate yourself? Whose problem are you solving in a better way than other people who might superficially sound as if they're doing the same thing as you?
I don't know. I don't really know how to answer that question because, you know, there's marketing agencies, there's sales enablement agencies, there's people you hire to fix the design sales presentations and websites. And it's not even like this competition. You can do this yourself. You can design your sales deck. You can write your story. You can do it all yourself. So it's not like I feel like I have any competition because the whole world is competition. So I don't focus on that at all. Does that make sense?
Well, okay. So how do you... It makes sense, but it makes it sound rather challenging to be you. And you don't look stressed out or miserable at all. You look like things are going quite well for you. You've got that. And so I'm wondering how do you what's your personal sales process? How do people find you? How do you sell?
I differentiate how I and how Pitch Kitchen solves their problem by how I solve that problem. So I just got off a call just before this webinar, well, not webinar, this, what is it called? A podcast.
Okay. Yeah. Premier, excellent podcast.
Yes, a global smash hit podcast, is it?
Global smash hit top 10 podcast. So this was a woman who's a CEO of a company that sells their solution to pharmaceutical companies. She heard about me because I produce a show on LinkedIn called Sales Therapy Show. And I had someone who she knows on the Sales Therapy Show. And I sent a message to all the CEOs that are connected to the person who I had on my Sales Therapy Show as a outbound sales process. And this person said, oh, so cool. I love what you guys are doing. Let's schedule a call. Then I got on the call with her. And what I did was I basically shared my screen and I took notes of the conversation and I started to ask basic questions like, what problem do you solve? And she spent about 15 minutes trying to even describe that because it was hard for her. But that whole process that she recognized that, gosh, this is really hard for me to describe the problem that we solve. This person who I'm talking to is all he's doing is taking notes and clarifying what I'm saying is a huge value. So after what, 30 minutes of taking notes of what problem they solve, what solution they're selling to, who they're selling to, what her goals are, what happens if she does nothing in a month from now, which by the way, is probably one of the most powerful conversations you can have. She told me at the end of that you have just demonstrated your ability to solve my problem by understanding what my problem is, by empathizing with my situation, and by showing me exactly how you're going to solve the problem. That was done in 30 minutes. So what is that, sales? I don't know if that's sales so much as like a therapy session. Mm. But that's how I differentiate myself. So to answer your question, Richard, could she have gone to an agency and had that? Probably. Could she have Googled a website design? Of course. So there's an infinite ways to solve that problem. But sometimes it happens through outbound sales, which is making connections with people, getting them on phone conversations, and demonstrating your ability to solve their problem.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I think anyone who's selling a service, I know that in the context of this podcast, who's solving a problem through a service that they provide, maybe, they should take note of how Greg's doing it, because having content on your LinkedIn profile that's relevant to the sort of people whose problems you can address is a very, very effective way of generating interesting leads if you do it well. Obviously, if you do it incredibly badly and the impression people get when they watch your LinkedIn show is that you're a boring, annoying person, it's probably not going to generate any leads. But that's
about that. I don't think anybody's watching my LinkedIn live show. I mean, it's a podcast. There are a few people that watch it, but I don't know that this person I just was selling to has ever watched the show, even though I mentioned it. Mm-hmm. I don't think she's actually ever seen it. But I think just by producing content and putting yourself out there with your purpose of what problems you're solving, that gives you credibility in and of itself. So you don't have to be stellar, you just have to do it.
Yeah, I definitely want to spend some time today talking about the pitch and the sales process and what you do, because I was actually a client and actually I thought it was really interesting. But before we get to that, let's just take a step back and maybe you can just tell us about how did you get started? Tell us about your career path a little bit. I mean, just tell us about your journey, basically. Like, how'd you start out? Yeah. What'd you study? what were you like? Or even growing up, yeah. were you entrepreneurial your whole life? Or were you what was your background? Just a bit about your your maybe childhood and just like even younger years going up.
Yeah, I guess my dad, come to think of it, he had went on an entrepreneur journey himself. He quit his job when I was a child and started a business putting high-end, high-fidelity sound systems in discotheques in New York City. So he actually became like the father of disco in New York. And you can Google him. He invented like tweeter arrays for Studio 54 and stuff. So I guess cool. I was inspired by my dad, who saw a problem or a need and, you know, thought that he could solve it and did. And my brother is also has his own business. And so I think I come from a family who likes to figure stuff out on their own. But my own personal journey was I went to design school, to art school, the best art school in the world, Cooper Union. I got accepted to that, graduated. I think to get into Cooper Union, there's like 6,000 people who applied and like 64 got in and 34 graduated with me. So it's like more than Harvard or Navy SEAL. It's like it's an art school. It's not military. Right. It's art, but still it's really hard. Right. So I graduated from art school, but then I was like, well, what am I going to do with art? Like, who wants to buy my art? So I like, well, commercial art, there's design, like, you know, there's, and this was even before Steve Jobs, there was Apple, I guess, was around, but I guess I was inspired by beautiful things and inspired by communication. So I was trying to figure out what am I going to do with that? And I wasn't very making much money doing commercial art at the time and graphic design.
Sorry, so you actually were working, Greg. You're actually, yeah. I mean, I don't know this at all about you. So I'm actually interested. So you're actually, you had a job. This was a job. You were like working in, yeah. What were you doing? You were actually selling.
I was working in an ad agency, Great Gray Advertising, doing design for ads, like design.
Oh, okay.
But I was low man on the totem pole, someone who would give me like, here, use these words, use this logo and make it look, put lipstick on the pig, so to speak. And okay. I would do it. And then, oh, the lipstick is all wrong. You've used the wrong color. And I was really frustrated with that whole thing because I was so far down the chain of creativity that it frustrated me. And I was not successful in that. So someone told me that I should go into sales because I can speak. And because I would probably make a lot of money doing sales. So I got a job doing translation sales. That was like an interesting thing.
That's quite a jump. Sorry, that's quite a jump from giving up. Was that a painful, because we're quite interested in like the key moments in your life. And, you know, was that quite a painful thing to give up your, because like translation sales and being an artist, or they're quite different, at least superficially. Maybe there's a hidden similarity.
An ad agency design work and translation sales. That's a massive, like, did you speak other languages? Did you, like, what made you go into that space? I mean,
I remember it was actually an ad. It was a job posting for a translation sales person for a company called Trans Image. It doesn't exist now, but it was born out of some folks in Berlitz, I think, who thought to design communications, design visual communications and written communications, so it was culturally appropriate to like Japanese audiences and German audiences and Chinese. So this is when like whatever. And so that fascinated me because it was like combining the design portion, the visual part of selling with the language part. So that was fascinating. Like, how do you design a brochure so the colors and the images are culturally appropriate? So that was the jump going from design to translation for me.
Okay. And so how did you enjoy translation? So and then I think you were in translation sales for a long time. Did you like that?
Yeah.
What was your
Well, I jumped into that. So I liked it because I got good at it. I learned everything about it. And then I started to enjoy the whole selling process, which for me has always been like therapy. Therapy, not just because you're helping people be better in their jobs and their careers, but therapy for me, because it's like very satisfying to help people solve problems. So I got good at it. And then I moved on to bigger translation companies, and then companies were acquired, and this all sorts of chaos in that space. But I think my most successful financial success I had an SDL. That was really when I was thinking what's next. Because I was, I think the aha moment I got of really a problem that I can solve for salespeople was clear when I was got the sales presentations that marketing would create that would give those decks, throw those decks over the wall to salespeople. here's our 15 slide sales deck. Go out and sell, go out and make your number. And I'd look at these sales decks, and slide one is like, you know, some pretty picture. Slide two, again, yeah. Lipstick on the pig. Slide two is, you know, all the logos that we work with. Slide three is like all our offices and how big we are, how awesome we are. And this stuff, not only did I gag when I looked at it, but I realized that the marketing people that made it thought that they were doing their job. They were promoting. They were selling. They were like, oh, let's just show how great we are. And they're thinking that marketing was something that, like, if you can scream the loudest, that you're a great marketer. And this was, you know, already 10 years ago. And marketing has changed so much since then, where it's no longer how loud you can scream, but it is how well you can connect with and have better conversations with your customers that have you win.
But I think this is fascinating, because you're discussing that, first of all, you mentioned SEO. SEO is a big translation company that got acquired, but it was actually publicly traded before. So I just wanted to emphasize, this was a big company, basically. So they obviously had a big marketing department, and they had a big sales team. And what's fascinating is that in big companies, you can have such a massive disconnect, because they were just not on the front line. They did not know what the client, I suspect, I'm just, this is what I'm just saying from listening to what you're saying, is that they didn't know what the client's problems were, or they weren't thinking about the client's problems. They were just as you said, who can scream the loudest? Like, we're big, we're shiny.
And indeed, there's something that anyone listening to this, no matter what business you're in, if you get to the scale of business, say things are going well and you've got marketing people whose job it is to deal with the brand and generating sales leads, and the salespeople whose job it is to bring in the business or solve problems in such a way that clients emerge, pay a lot of attention between the interaction between sales and marketing, because there's very often that's a can of worms. I don't want you to diss your former employers unnecessarily, but it sounds like things weren't perfect if they were giving you bad presentations and you weren't in a position to solve that.
Well, it wasn't SDL's fault. I'm speaking about the pandemic of marketing, what marketers are hired to market. They're going to wake up in the morning and market, market, market. What does it mean to market? I believe that sales enablement is the new marketing. It really, you need to enable sales to have the right conversations with customers. And that's not about promotion. That's about having several very specific conversations about their problems, about their goals, about their desired outcomes, and about the plan of how you're going to get them from where they are today to where they want to go. And these things that I'm just talking about were completely absent from any sales deck that I got from marketing from any company I've ever worked for. So having recognized this, saying, fuck this, I've got a quota on my back. I need to sell. I need to figure this out. I'm going to use my design skills. Oh shit, this design skills that I got from Cooper Union, my advertising skills that I got when I worked in an advertising agency. I'm going to combine all that with my knowledge of how to sell, which is how to have the right conversations. So I started to design slides as each slide is a conversation, almost like a deck of cards. You know, do we need to use the Jack of Clubs here to have a conversation about outcomes? Or do we need to use the Ace of Spades, which is a conversation about the problems? So I started to design slides for the company as I was with, and now then as a side hustle, for companies to have very specific conversations. And these slides were totally killing it. They were winning because they were visuals that anchored the conversation, that facilitated the transformation of people's minds from what they were doing today to what they wanted to do. So it was really working. I started making money on the side, and I got to a point where I started making more money doing that on the side than and in stealth mode than like commission checks from selling translation services. So it was scary, but I said, I'm going to just do this. And also, I didn't have a good month or quota. And I was like, oh, shit, you know, maybe I'm not going to make as much money as I'd like here. So it was a pretty clear option.
So you were doing quite well, because you had a good position at SDL, which was one of the biggest companies in the industry. And obviously you can't do badly at that job for long, because you don't keep your job if you're in sales, right? So you must have been doing quite well on your side gig, and it wasn't that risky in a sense, because you already had clients when you started, right?
Well, it's not like the clients are sort of churnable, meaning like once you finish the project, you need to hustle to get your next project. So are you still there, by the way?
Yeah.
I think my screen just...
It flashed for a second.
It wasn't like I had, you know, steady cash cows to keep paying me. It was a commitment to that, hey, this life that I need to hustle for my next project is very similar to my last life, to hustle to get the next sale. But every dollar that I earn is for me and my family.
It stays
business.
With you, yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So you just jumped in. So basically you just took the plunge. I mean, you said, look, I'm going to, you know, whatever. This looks like it's a promising, whatever opportunity. And then you did it. And then like, so then take us from there. So then what happened? What happens? Did you have to invest money, or did you just still sort of grow like guerrilla, as you call it, stealth mode, like, or call it guerrilla tactics? I mean, you just kept it lean and then grew it up. And yeah, talk to us about how long has it been, actually? Give us this also sense of like, when did this happen?
And maybe how big you are now, what scale you're at now?
4 years. And I'm about running at about a, my goal for 2021 is to be at $1 million of business.
So, nice.
Yeah. And I have one copywriter and one designer and a project manager and an accountant. Everybody else is freelance.
Okay.
And I'm happy to grow more than that. But I'm also happy not to grow more than that. So.
And so basically what's the typical, cause one of the conversations I really want to have with you, but like, and let's just open it up by like, what's the typical problem? Like you sort of described what the therapy that you just did, like before this, that you helped the lady understand the problem. I know what you did with us, but like, maybe you can just talk a little bit about what your typical, what's your typical client like, and what's the typical process look like?
Sure. Typical client is a CEO. I only work with CEOs of companies that already recognize the problems that we're talking about, that their homepage may be pretty, but it's not working. It's not working to convert. Their sales presentation may be nicely designed, but it's not working to have them have the right conversations, them or the salespeople. So there's really three things that we offer. The first is a story, strategic story, which is critical for them to clarify what it is they're selling, who they're selling to, what problem they're solving. And we put that in something called a brand script. Donald Miller from StoryBrand calls it a brand script. We also took on something from Andy Raskin, who I think if you Google best sales deck in the world, you'll see some of his advice about a formula for telling a great story. And so his formula is typically, I would say foundationally, to contrast the old world against the new world, the old way or the status quo way versus the way it could be.
Like sort of before and after stories, basically.
Yeah, that's very, very powerful storytelling there. So we combine both the Donald Miller approach with the Andy Raskin approach to, we have a way to use those rubrics to develop a story formula, story basis for the homepage, for the sales presentation, so that allows salespeople to have great conversations that position themselves as the trusted advisor, trusted guide in the transformation story of how people are doing things today to how they could be doing things, or what they're doing things, how, what they're doing today versus what they could be doing. That's a transformation story. And if you're selling, you need to position yourself as a guide, an advisor in helping that person, that, that CEO or that customer transform.
I'd imagine that the CEOs you're dealing with might be sort of 10, 20, 50, 100 person companies, because obviously the CEO of Coca-Cola or Boeing, you know, the question is the web page working for the CEO of Boeing, actually she or he might be involved in the sales process, but it's a slightly different proposition in a really big company to a CEO who's actively involved in sales, I would imagine.
Right. So Andy Raskin, I know, works with CEOs of those large companies. I work with CEOs in mid, small, medium sized companies, not the billion dollar companies, but companies that are either, you know, $10 to $50 million in revenue, and they're chicken scratching to get to the next level.
Okay. Yeah, I, as I mentioned multiple times here, I actually used your services, and you know the way you described that, I'm not sure that people like it. It sounds kind of abstract, but it actually, this really is important, and I want to talk a little. I want to draw a little more attention to it because I think it's really, really good. Like you mentioned a couple of things there. First of all, the concept of the guide, that we become the guide, we the company, we the salesperson become the guide, and we help. And it's basically, we need to understand the path that where are our clients going and what is their story as well. And we're trying to guide them along that path. Right. And I think that's very, very powerful. And it was very different. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Let's go back to where we started. You said like, what do you do? What's your pitch? And that's the problem with most sales pitches. Most people don't think of themselves as the guide. When they're selling, they don't think of themselves as the helper. They think of themselves as the hero of the story. You know, if you
exactly.
Look at archetypes, there's you know, villain, there's victims, there's heroes, there's guides, there's nemesises, there's, you know, comedic sidekicks. So in the whole, in the story that you're telling for your business, who are you? What's your place? What's your position? And what story are you telling? This is a really important conversation to have, because if you tell the wrong story to your salespeople, everyone's telling different stories, nothing's going to happen.
Right.
Everyone will be mad.
No, but listen, I mean, first of all, I love this, and you maybe you can talk about this a little bit, but like you actually gave examples about movies, but like companies generally are positioning themselves as the hero.
Yeah.
But the hero is the client. And that's really something you talked about and you drew our attention to. And I think that's really interesting. So yeah, just like maybe you want to talk a little bit about
how. Yeah, sure.
I think you used Star Wars. I think you used Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker and Obi-Wan when we were doing it. I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, for sure. So, you know, when you watch a movie and what you love about a movie like Star Wars, for example, is you identify with different characters, story, who you like, who you don't like. But people love transformation stories. They go to the movies because there's something about their lives that in our lives, so you know what, I'm facing, you know, challenges in my life. I'm facing problems, but I'm the hero of my own story. I want to be able to overcome these challenges and be better. Everyone is looking to grow. Everyone is looking to be better. Every organization is looking to grow and be better. So every organization sees themselves as the heroes of their own stories. That's natural. That's perfect. Now, if you're selling, though, if you're in, you're a business that you're helping other organizations be heroes, then you better get clear that you're not the hero of their story. You better get clear. Otherwise, you're going to have sales presentations that, by the way, look like the ones that I got from SDL, which are slide after slide about how awesome we are, which nobody cares about.
And there's an issue here. There's a great, I don't know if you knew Jerry Lynch, who was a really important, retired quite recently, a really key guy in Argos Multilingual. And I remember him talking about how the importance of building confidence. And he said, you need to get to a situation when you're with a client where at some stage you say, what you need is this to help you solve your problem. But unless you're trusted by the client.
Yeah.
To be that guide, a guide who might lead you astray is a terrible guide. And you know, we live in a world where there are bad actors out there. So a couple of questions follow up on that. How do you advise people to get that confidence? And do you ever say no to a client if you basically feel that they're actually trying to sell something that, it's best not to sell?
Yeah. Challenger sale is great but it only works if you have that trust and rapport. And you only get that trust and rapport by being empathetic. And really saying things and really connecting with, your organization really deserves, you've got great products. Yeah, we do have great products. Your organization really deserves to have what you're looking for. We do deserve. So if you can really connect empathetically with people and get like what Chris Voss, who wrote the book, Never Split the Difference, ex-FBI hostage negotiator says, get a that's right from your statements of connection, statements of empathy, then that is the foundation to then go to the next step, which is telling them what they need. Almost like a doctor empathizing with a problem of a patient.
Yeah, I was just going to say for our listeners, we'll try and put a list of these different book references that Greg's making in the show notes. So if you drop these over to us afterwards, we can put those all together, because I think you don't have to write it down if you don't want to, if you're listening. If you're driving at 130 kilometers down an autostrada in Poland, please don't write things down with your one hand on your phone.
Yeah, so great book by Chris Voss. I'm not sure if you read it, Never Split the Difference, How to Negotiate Like Your Life Depends on It. He's ex-FBI hostage negotiator. And I learned more about empathy and connecting with people from that book than I have in any business book, strangely enough. And he was negotiating the lives of people on the line where they're cutting fingers off, unless they get millions of dollars. And so how do you negotiate with people that are about to do that stuff? And he talks a lot about the power of getting a that's right from people. And the power of, getting that's right. Does that make sense?
As you said, it's the foundation. You're calling that the foundation. Then you can build off of that. So, like in your experience with salespeople, we're talking about the tools that help salespeople. But do you find salespeople are robotic? How much of this? Even if you give the tool. I'm just wondering, even if you give them the tools of a great pitch deck and a great story, or how do you convert there's one job here that we're talking about, right? Is like this awesome conceptual things. Like, I'm going to create a story. This is going to be great. We're going to guide them along and all that. But then you have a team of salespeople that have to actually execute on that. And do you find that a challenge? Like, and how much of your work is trying to convert from the marketing, from the pitch to the actual implementation of this?
There are three things that Pitch Kitchen does. First is the strategy, which is the brand script and the story. The second is the design of the homepage, the sales presentation, some collateral. And the third is the training. And I have to say, for companies that we deliver the first two to, I would say out of 10 salespeople, there'd be 6 salespeople, maybe 5 salespeople that get this presentation. They look at it. They're like, oh, shit, this is great. I can run with this. I could use these slides to have the conversations that I need in order to make my sales. There are going to be 2 to 3 salespeople out of 10 that are going to be like, wait a minute. This doesn't look like a brochure. There are no page numbers. I want to send this to people. And if I send this to people, they're not going to know what they're looking at. And so they won't really get it because they won't really understand. They'll think that what they're getting is another website. Like, no. This is a presentation. If you want to send something to someone, send them to your homepage. That actually should have the story. And if you're embarrassed to send people to your homepage, well, that you got a bigger problem, right? That's outside of sales. But salespeople should be so proud to send their customers to their homepage, which should have everything that their customer needs to understand and get to the first conversation with the salesperson so that they're far along the process, the buying process. The slide should help pick up that conversation and allow the salesperson to facilitate deep discovery and get a that's right from their customer. It should facilitate those conversations. So those 2 salespeople out of the 10 will need some discussion to and they'll be like, okay, I get it now. And then they're off to the races. But then I think you're going to have 2 or 3 salespeople out of the 10 that really are going to need some training or some firing. I'm not sure which. One of the two.
I appreciate the fact you're using direct language, because sometimes people, you know, dance around these things. They say they're looking for career development outside the organization or whatever, and that means firing, right?
Yeah, but I think this is like super interesting what you're talking about. That basically you're asking, what you're saying is the job of the salesperson is to have a conversation. The job of the salesperson is not to send an email with a bunch of information. Yeah. You see, people need information, drive them to the website, but then have your website regurgitate these people back out as people that want to have conversations. Yes. And then you're using the decks, and that's where the struggle is. You're giving these salespeople what they're used to is, you know, this is who we are. This is how big we are. This is.
Yes.
And yeah, so that's, I don't know.
That's why I call sales enablement. Sorry. Sales enablement is a better word than marketing, I think.
And how do you feel about the sales process when there's no human involved? I'm going to be mentoring a company next week, which is making explainer videos. And for me, they know exactly what an explainer video is. And I was querying exactly what that meant, but I think their basic idea is that somebody goes onto the homepage, can watch a video, and like actually get from that video almost to the point of buying. Or you go to Amazon.com, you actually buy without talking to a human being at all. And can you service people who would like to achieve sales without a human involvement?
Well, sure. Yeah, I mean, that's what a homepage could do. But I think it comes down to the product itself. If the product, in order for someone to be successful with the thing that you're selling, in order for them to be successful, you need to configure, explain, process, deploy, service, customize. If any of those things are required for your customer to be successful, there's no way in hell someone's going to go on your website, watch an explainer video, and purchase.
That makes sense.
If you're hoping to like replace the salesperson with an explainer video, that's not going to happen, I don't think, for most complex. I see what you're saying. Maybe there's some super simple widget that you need to sell.
Yesterday I bought a laptop. All right. But I didn't buy it on the web. I bought it over the phone with Apple. And I had a human being actually talk to me about the options on the laptop. I enjoyed the exchange. It was great. I bought the laptop. But of course, I could have went and bought it online. Mm. So I think there'll always be some buyers, even in a world where laptops are for sale, where you can, of course, buy it on a credit card. We are living in a world where there are going to be customers that want to have an experience with a human being to buy something.
Totally. I mean, we're three guys, you know, white men in their 50s who are sort of coming from a certain generation. There may be people half our age who say, hang on a moment, they're wrong. And we could be wrong. There might be a way of doing this that doesn't work this way. But certainly...
Yeah, but complex. I'm sticking...
I agree. I totally...
Complex things need human interaction.
I totally agree that I think you're... correct, and the idea of someone buying some enterprise resource planning software like SAP without talking to a human being. I mean, you're talking mission critical products and services for your company. It's highly unlikely you'll just buy that without.
It's even more complex than that. It's not just does it need to be service configured, explained, customized. It is how many people does it touch in order for it to be successful, and how many people need to be involved in the decision to make this change of how they're doing things today versus how they should be doing things. You know, that's the job of a salesperson, to help all those people get on board with that change, to facilitate that change.
Mm, totally. And I was just going to say, this is one of the opportunities that people have who work in larger corporations, that you come across problems. For example, Greg came across the problem of sales presentations by working as a sales guy in a large company, which didn't have had ones that could be better. I'm sure they weren't bad by the standards of the industry. The standards weren't that good. But, you know, sometimes you see things about the way things work, and particularly in B2B sales, as a consumer, you don't necessarily understand the way things work. And sometimes, astonishingly, in 2021, the way things work is really lamentably bad, which is bad at one level. And on the other level, there are plenty of opportunities to start businesses that address problems that other people may not be aware of.
Sure.
Where do you, let's say two questions about the future. One, your personal journey, like where do you want to take this? What are your goals with this, with this business? And maybe the second question about what's the future of sales? Those are huge. I mean, the second one is a huge one, but let's start with the first one about Pitch Kitchen and then we can see about the second.
So, organically growing is how I've basically done things and hustling to find business on LinkedIn and doing outbound emailing. But I'm experimenting now with, I would say, Facebook ads and webinars to get people to that first conversation and get people to that first conversation where they're more clear about their own problem and they're clear about what my company would do to help them solve that problem. So my goal is to have that first conversation that I have with customers to be not really about sales, but really about specifically how we're going to help them solve their specific problems, almost like a doctor-patient kind of relationship. That's my goal. And so that's what I'm actively investing in now so that I could scale up Pitch Kitchen to the place that I wanted to make it. I don't need to be a $50 million company, but I want to be big enough to employ the people who I love working with and can help a lot more businesses, a lot more CEOs be successful and close more deals.
And then would you sell it? I mean, obviously, you know, you mentioned, you know, you're in your mid-50s, so you've presumably people don't retire as at the age they used to retire, but you presumably would you carry on doing this for decades or do you just
I can't even think that far. I'm not even thinking like that. I just want to create this vision I have of a company doing great things for great companies and take it from there. I have a view to sell it.
And Kimon asked about the future of sales, which is a very simple question, so I'm sure you can just dash off an answer to what's going to happen to sales.
Are there going to be bots? Are there going to be people? Like, are we going to have AI replace the humans? I mean, we just talked about the fact that there's no explainer videos, but we didn't discuss the future, like the future future.
So I have a bunch of different ideas about this. Of course, any task that can be repeated will be done by AI. Any task, and you look at this, even the task that a salesperson does, a lot of those tasks are being automated. So I think, of course, the future of sales and salespeople is great because I think getting back to what your customers want most, your customers want to be heard. They want to talk to someone who really understands their problem and empathizes with them. And that's not going away. And when I say that's not going away, the customers can't really tell the difference between your product and the product that somebody else is selling. You look at, like, I'm going to flash this. I'm like, you know, is this an iPhone or is this a Samsung? Can't really tell. I mean, at a distance, all products pretty much look the same. So that you're going to differentiate yourself, not by what you're selling, but by how you're selling it. And are you really connecting on an emotional level with your customers? And do they feel like they can trust and they feel comfortable that you understand their problem? And through working with you and your organization, you're going to help them solve that problem. That's the job of a salesperson, and that's not going away, for sure.
I have one, I'm conscious of the time, but I have one that I think we need to touch on, because we've been talking about sales and pitches, but one of the things that you're sort of, I think you're like sort of a guru in, and that because in actually promoting your own business, you've gone out there and like you've become are you a LinkedIn influencer? I mean, like you're a very, very sort of active person on LinkedIn. And I think that you've embraced that you've come from this traditional, let's say, sales world, but now you've set up your own business. And I think you've embraced a very modern way of promoting your business. And I know that you do a show on LinkedIn. I know you're extremely active on LinkedIn. I don't know where else you mentioned Facebook, but maybe you can talk a little bit about how you, you sort of touched on this throughout, but like maybe you can talk a little bit about your, you know, what you think about this. And so you got like a small business, and how do you get this thing out there in the world, in the modern world, basically?
Yeah. So my playbook on LinkedIn, I learned a lot from some great people. Like I learned from Jake Dunlap, is a great person to follow. He's a consulting sales consulting company called Scaled Consulting. Also, Joe Applebaum on LinkedIn. I learned a lot from him. But I think that on LinkedIn, you can pick up some nuggets of gold and some playbooks, some techniques and some approaches so that you could meet your goals on LinkedIn. My goals on LinkedIn are three things. One, to establish myself in the tribe of B2B companies as the go-to person to talk about revamping your homepage and your story so that it connects better with customers. And so the Sales Therapy Show was an idea I had to invite CEOs to talk about the problems. Talk about problems that sales leaders have and CEOs have, and also the problems that they solve for their customers. So it's like a problem-centric conversation. So I want to be known for that in this tribe on LinkedIn. So my show doesn't get many views, but it's almost like a meditation. It's like something I just do. And I think maybe over the next 5 years or 10 years, it will start to bear fruit. But it's already bearing fruit now. Like the opportunity I had just early this morning came from some of the activity that I did around that show and outbound. So,
but what I'm
not getting off topic. I'm just trying to get a sense of the scale that you've got. If you're aiming for around $1 million revenue this year, I'm imagining that your sort of typical client might be $20,000, $50,000, $70,000. There's a level below which, and you're selling to CEOs who are so. Where I'm going with this is that you can afford to put quite a lot of effort into each sale, because if you're selling things that cost $500 each, there's a limit to how much you can spend in terms of time and resource on bringing people in. Can you talk about your typical to average project size and if someone's listening and think, oh, I want to hire Greg, and it turns out they've only got $500, presumably they're not for you, right?
Right. No. So it goes back to how much value, what is it they're selling? So typically the CEOs that we work with are selling products or services or solutions that cost at least $50,000, at least. And if they have 5 salespeople, that means, you know, that's $250,000 a month if they're having one deal per month, or 10 deals per month. And but that's just one deal. Let's say that customer is $50,000, but the lifetime of that customer could be like, you know, $200,000 to $500,000. So that's the companies that we work with, at least $50,000, but averaging about that, maybe $100,000. So if that's what they're getting, so they're spending with us to nail down their story, nail their message, nail their sales presentation, get their salespeople up to speed, nail their homepage so that it's converting more people to get into the conversation. They're going to be spending to do all that work somewhere between $25,000 to $50,000. And, you know, our competitors, you know, charge a lot more than that. But, you know, Duarte charges just for a sales presentation about $60,000. Andy Raskin, I think, charges about $75,000 just for the story, just for the messaging. So, you know, we have a package that's, you know, I think appropriate for small, medium-sized businesses.
So, yeah, I want to get back to. Yeah, sorry. You've already taken it away from mine. So go ahead, finish.
I'll keep on. So you know, $50,000 per customer when they come on board. So you can put a lot of your cost of acquisition is quite hard to measure. Do you measure your cost of acquisition, like how much it costs you to bring a client? It's quite tricky in a medium sized small business, isn't it?
Measure. Because a lot of the work has been organic. And like spending a lot of time on LinkedIn and creating relationships with people, I have not measured that. And it's hard to measure that. But since I'm now moving to a Facebook funnel model, it'll be very clear. Like, okay, I spent, you know, $500 for this acquisition, you know, that'll be clear. But right now, I'm not measuring it that way. because it's all very, it's almost like a labor of love to get the business I'm getting organically, because I'm spending a lot of time myself making outreach.
Yeah, I just want to go back to what I was, because I'm trying to, because I think it's really valuable if you're setting up a small business or a small entrepreneur and you're setting up, to hear how do you, so you mentioned Facebook, sorry, you mentioned LinkedIn, the show, but like, what's your, like, what would be your advice to some small business, somebody who's just setting up their business or has a small business, you know, they don't have massive budgets. Like, what's the best use? Where do they get the most bang for their buck? What's the most best use of it? And let's say that I don't want to, let's say we're sticking with that you're in your space, like you're selling some kind of consulting. It's kind of a service, like pretty much in your sort of space that you can sell to these medium-sized companies. I think that's a big piece of the entrepreneurial whatever universe. So,
yeah. I don't really know that I have like a generic outreach formula that works. I don't really know if I have that to offer anybody. I know what I have to offer is to get really clear on your anthem, your platform. Like what are your three words, for example? What is your Make America Great Again? What is your, you know, whether you like or hate Donald Trump, those five words got him elected. It starts with a verb and it calls his people to action. So what is your 3 to 5 word story that starts with a verb and calls your people to action? I think that's really important to have, because once you have that, then that could cascade all the content that you write, all the stories that you're putting out there, all the emails that you're sending outbound. It's anchored on a singular message, a singular story that calls your people to change. And I think that's what excites me about helping people with that, because then no matter what strategy you decide on LinkedIn or outbound email or whatever, you've got your, you've nailed your story. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't know, Kimon, if I have like, you know, a recipe for how to be like.
Yeah, it's more like what tools should I use? I mean, I love the Make America Great Again. That's a brilliant piece of advice. I thought that's an awesome, like that's a distilled thing. I was sort of going after, do I use LinkedIn? How do I use LinkedIn? Do I use Facebook? Is Facebook any valuable? Like, I'm just, or like, what do I do if I want to get people to pay attention to me? Am I making content? Am I doing podcasts? Am I doing, what should I do?
I can't say that I have had success. I basically look at it as failure. With all the work that I've done on LinkedIn and putting messages out there and connecting with people and the content, I think it's an epic failure, because I don't see any good return on all that time. I don't.
Okay.
So I don't have advice for anybody about what the strategy is. I do it because I enjoy doing it. I feel like it's like a long game I'm playing, and it's a fingers crossed strategy. And I don't want to give anybody a fingers crossed.
Okay. I think you're right though. I mean, like Richard, I have to go back to your, I think you said Marshall, the guy who owns this channel that we're on or runs or set up the company, MBN. Didn't you say that like the key is like exists for podcasts? It's actually longevity. So it is what you're saying, Greg. It's like being around. It's not that the flash in the pan that I spent 6 months on this. It's actually, I've been doing this for a very long time. I don't know, Richard, do you want to comment on what that
Yeah, sure. We have a lot of discussions about how to market podcasts, and it's very hard to market podcasts, and what Marshall, and he's been doing it for 13 years, and it's, you know, number one in the world for sort of academic book review podcasts. What we're doing is a slightly broadening the channel things that NBN does. But he says, if you go onto the internet and you start doing something well and you stick at it for 5 to 7 years, you'll be one of the best people in the world doing that thing, because most people try it for a bit and they give up. And putting out good quality content consistently, and you know, but the key is good quality. You have to know what you're talking about, and you know, it may be your audience is different from Seth Godin's, and Seth Godin's a great man and he's got very interesting insights about marketing and he's got a huge audience, but you need to find your voice and find your audience, don't you? Because there might be other ways of approaching this that other people do with success as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, find your voice and find your audience. And that's really hard to do. And I think that's often what I help people figure out. because it's almost like, you know, even myself, I'm hiring a coach now for the development of this Facebook campaign. And I need an outsider to help me see my blind spots about how I'm talking about the work that I'm doing. And I think that's always very healthy for us to do as business owners to get that advice. So, yeah.
Totally. We're coming towards the close of our time. A couple of questions. And one thing I'd draw attention to, you talked about failure, that it's really important, particularly if you're doing quite well, not to get arrogant. And note that Greg is doing well. He's got clients, he's on track, and he's not completely happy with the way things are. And, you know, the smug, self-satisfied entrepreneur quite often isn't neither a very attractive person to hang out with, nor is destined for success. That, you know that it's not perfect. And that's actually quite a healthy situation to be in, which brings me on to two final questions, which is, do you see yourself as a lucky person? Did you like to get to this situation? Were you lucky? And also, are you competitive? Do you benchmark yourself against like other people and think, I'm not doing as well as them, and it bugs you? Or are you quite just happy doing your own track, and what other people get up to doesn't matter to you at all?
Yeah, interesting. I think I've always considered myself to be so lucky and so grateful. I've been through such shit in the last year and a half. We've all been through. COVID has really, screwed our lives up in so many ways. Mine, in particularly, going through a divorce, and now I'm creating a new family. So lots of chaos there. But I can, I'm so blessed. I'm so lucky. I have great health and surrounded by people who love me in spite of my who I really am. So. So they love
they me. might listen to this podcast, so that might flag a few questions,
They love me in spite of who I am. So I'm blessed to have that in my life and be healthy and all that, for sure. And I do consider myself lucky. So yeah, about your second question, I think when I worked at SDL, Timo, when I worked as a salesperson, I saw some really good salespeople. I worked with some great salespeople there, and I never really considered like competition, whether they're other salespeople competition, or even now, I feel like it's the same way. I don't consider some of my quote competitors to be competitors, because I really feel like we're all so unique in how we sell. Even the people that I sold shoulder to shoulder against, we were all so different, as people, and that we all had our different approaches to selling and the different kinds of customers that we would be winning in. Just to be specific, some were winning with pharmaceuticals and some were winning with high tech or manufacturing. And so each of us were sort of gravitating towards our own niches. So I don't know if I answered your question, but I don't really feel like...
You didn't feel, I would say the answer would be you didn't feel like you were like, that wasn't a driving force for you.
No.
Was the competitors. Okay, so let's start to wrap it up. Need to say thank you. Let's start with thanking all the people that joined and listened to Greg today. Took an hour of their lives and spent it with us and got to know Greg and his story. I hope we learned something, particularly about, I think the sales and marketing piece is like super, super interesting here. My daughter, Magda Fontakidis, she does the actual video editing. She does the teaser and all that stuff. So shout out to her. Magda Bujskoszt, who is our high school 17-year-old intern who does PR and promotion. Everybody at NBN who actually does the technical stuff to get this up and running and helps promote this. If you like this, please subscribe at NBN, YouTube, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And obviously, share, like, click, super like. This is awesome. When you get a chance. And obviously, Greg, thank you. I've known you for a long time. I learned obviously a lot about you here today. And I think you have an inspiring story, and particularly your insights into sales, I think are super valuable for anybody that wants to get into the business. So thanks for taking
thank
the time.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Timo. Thank you for those warm-hearted feelings. I feel them. I feel you, bro. And Richard, so nice to see you again. Thank you for having me on the show.
It's been a pleasure.